A Dog's Way Home is a beautifully told, charming tale that explores the unbreakable bond between us and those we love. This is a fantastic and exhilarating journey of the heart that brilliantly speaks to the incredible power of love and resilience of spirit that tie us together. A Dog's Way Home by W. Bruce Cameron. Starting Wednesday at noon and Thursday at 2 a.m. on Recording Library of West Texas Radio. Read by listening.
Now here's your forecast for the Midland, Odessa area. It's 60 and clear. Tonight clear with a low in the low 50s. Then tomorrow clear with a high in the mid 60s. Tomorrow night clear with a low in the low 50s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 10 a.m.
This program is made available to the IAAIS Program Share and was recorded at the Audio Reading Service of the Ellen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana, for people with print impairments.
Hello and welcome. This is Independent Living, and I'm your reader, Leslie, with the Audio Reading Service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Today I'll be reading from several health newsletters. The first one is from the Mayo Clinic Health Letter, and I'll start with the first article, Eye Emergencies. 1 minute you're ticking through the day's to-do list. The next, a burst of black dots appears in your field of vision, and your vision starts to blur at the edges. Panic sets in. Eye emergencies can be traumatic. Many involve injury from an accident. You're popping a champagne bottle, for example, or the grandkids get a hold of the bottle of cleaning solution. Others are the result of long-term developments related to internal diseases. Many eye injuries can be prevented. Simple and common sense protective measures, such as wearing eye protection, will minimize your risk. If an emergency does happen, knowing how to respond can make a big difference in saving vision. Your eyes may seem delicate, but they're surprisingly resilient. The front part of your eyes, the white part, the sclera, the dark spot in the middle is the pupil, and the colored portion that surrounds it is the iris, absorb impact and are most visibly damaged in a traumatic or chemical eye injury. But injuries can affect any part of the eye, each of which plays a role in allowing sight. For example, number one, the cornea. The cornea is a protective dome of clear tissue at the front of your eye. Its curved surface helps focus light rays before they're fine-tuned by the lens. And the next thing is the lens. The lens is a clear oval structure that sits behind the iris. The curvature of your lens changes to sharpen your focus. And the last one is the vitreous cavity. The vitreous cavity extends from the back of the lens to the back of your eyeball, helping to maintain its shape. This area is filled with a clear jelly-like substance called the vitreous. Structures at the back of your eye also play an important behind-the-scenes role in your vision, including the retina. The retina is a thin layer of tissue lining the back inner wall of your eyeball. It consists of millions of cells that capture the images focused onto them by your cornea and lens. When light hits these cells, electrical impulses are generated and carried to your optic nerve. Then there's the macula. The macula is a specialized part of the retina located in the center of the back of the eye. This patch of densely packed, light-sensitive cells is essential to your central vision and allows you to see fine detail. And finally, there's the optic nerve. The optic nerve carries information gathered by your retina to your brain. Preventing problems. One common type of eye emergency, a retinal detachment, occurs when the retina painlessly pulls away from the wall of the eye, often suddenly and unexpectedly. It can be related to a tear developing in your retina due to either age or trauma, or without an obvious cause. It can also be related to diseases such as diabetes. Areas where the retina is detached can no longer receive the blood flow or nourishment they need, causing your vision to decrease. This requires emergency evaluation. While you may not be able to prevent a retinal detachment, it's recommended that you see your eye doctor regularly, especially if you are over 65 and have risk factors such as advanced diabetes, high blood pressure, or inflammatory eye disease. Other common emergencies, such as accidental trauma from a flying object or chemical burns, can often happen by accident. Those accidents occur in the workplaces during leisure activity or even at home. So preventative measures include, number one, using a splatter shield when cooking bacon or other foods that emit flying oils and grease from the pan. Number two, keeping all chemicals such as cleaners and bleach out of the reach of children. Never mix chemicals. Use only as directed while wearing protective safety glasses. Always wash hands immediately after use to avoid rubbing your eyes. Number three, wearing protective safety glasses when using a hammer or power tools, such as a saw or drill. Keep your distance at all times from others using tools to avoid flying debris. Number four, opening corked bottles, such as champagne, outside and pointed away from you and all others. Number five, always wearing protective safety glasses when using power equipment outside, including lawnmowers, edgers, chainsaws, and clipping shears. All can send debris flying at high speeds. Number six, keeping bungee cords at arm's length away from your body. They're a common cause of eye injuries from snapping. And number seven, supervising children's use of sharp objects such as pens, scissors, forks, and knives. Stay calm and have a plan. If an eye emergency happens to you or someone in your vicinity, it's important to remain calm and know how to respond until you get medical care. Every situation is different, but mild corneal abrasion, such as from a baby or a dog scratch, and small amounts of dirt or sand in the eye usually do not require emergency medical care, but should be evaluated, particularly if irritation persists. In general, any sudden loss of vision, whether partial or full, whether in one or both eyes, or whether painful or not, indicates a need for urgent evaluation by an eye doctor. In some cases, vision loss may be accompanied by other signs and symptoms, such as nausea and vomiting, swelling or redness, and inflammation around the eye, or fevers. So there's a table below that will guide your decisions with some of the more common eye emergencies. So here's the table. Okay, for the first eye emergency, posterior vitreous detachment, retinal detachment, retinal tear, and other retinal pathology. Here are the signs and symptoms. In one or both eyes, sudden visual appearance of many floaters, perhaps like a shower of dots or a swarm of bees, flashes of light, blurring or peripheral vision, a curtain over part of the vision. And here's what to do. Seek urgent medical care, including care from an eye doctor. The next eye emergency would be chemical splashed in the eyes. The signs and symptoms would be stinging, burning, redness, pain, blurry vision, and swollen eyelids. Here's what to do. Flush your eyes with water and seek immediate medical care. Do not wipe or rub your eye. If possible, take a picture of the product label so the doctors know the chemical makeup. The next eye emergency is cut or punctured eyes. Signs and symptoms are bleeding, discoloration of the sclera, which is the white part, sharp pain, unusual pupil size, one eye sticking out farther than the other. And here's what to do. Seek immediate medical care. Place a protective shield, such as the end of a clean paper cup, over affected eye. Do not touch the eye. Do not wash with water or other liquid. Do not take aspirin, ibuprofen, or other pain relievers, as they may worsen the bleeding. And finally, the eye emergency of a blow to the eye socket, such as being punched or being struck by a baseball. Signs and symptoms would be swelling and discoloration around the eye, pain, dizziness, and blurred vision. And here's what to do. Apply a sterile cold compress to ease pain and swelling. Don't use frozen vegetables or steak, as they can cause infection, and you should seek medical care. And here's a sidebar. Removing a foreign object from your eye. Clearing your own eye. If it's a minor issue, such as a small particles of dust, blink several times may remove the particles. If this doesn't work, try to flush the object with clean, warm water or saline solution. Use an eye cup or small clean glass. Position the glass with its rim resting on the bone at the base of your eye socket and pour the fluid in, keeping the eye open. Take note, whether cleaning your own eye or someone else's, if the object is large and makes closing the eye difficult, or is made of something sharp, such as metal or glass, and can't be flushed out, or is embedded in the eyeball, do not touch or rub the eye. Cover it with a paper cup taped to the face and forehead and seek emergency care immediately. And here's how to clearing someone else's eye. Wash your hands first, seat the person in a well-lighted area, examine the eye to find the object, gently pull the lower lid out, and ask the person to look up. Then hold the upper lid while the person looks down. If the object is floating in the tear film or on the surface of the eye, try using eye drops to flush it out or irrigate as described above. This next article is called Pancreatic Cancer: New Treatments, Better Outcomes. Pancreatic cancer begins in the tissues of your pancreas, an organ in your abdomen that lies behind the lower part of your stomach. Pancreatic cancer often doesn't cause symptoms in its early stages when it's most curable. Thus, in many people with pancreatic cancer, the cancer has spread to other organs at the time of diagnosis. In this group, treatment is limited to chemotherapy only and does not cure the cancer. For people in whom the cancer has not spread to other organs, treatment options may include surgery, chemotherapy, radiation therapy, or a combination of these, with the only known curative treatment being surgery. And historically speaking, only a small percentage of people with confined cancer would have been considered candidates for surgery. However, in 2019, Mayo Clinic doctors published research advances related to a specific subset of people with pancreatic cancer that would have been previously considered inoperable. This subset is the roughly one-third of people in whom the cancer has not spread to other organs, but the tumor has grown outside of the pancreas to involve critical blood vessels adjoining the pancreas. The research showed a dramatic survival benefit of surgery for those who underwent a specific treatment plan of chemotherapy and chemoradiation before surgery. Here, Dr. Mark Trutte, a Mayo Clinic surgeon and lead author of the study, answers our questions about the findings. So here's the first question. You found that people who meet three criteria before surgery tend to have the best outcomes. Could you briefly explain each criterion? And here's his answer. The first is extended chemotherapy before surgery. We found that the more cycles of effective chemotherapy people receive before surgery, the longer they live. Many cancer doctors, oncologists, have feared that giving too much chemotherapy may somehow weaken a person or cause toxicities that would preclude an operation later on. But this is not the case. Also, some oncologists worried that if we don't intervene surgically soon, then we would lose our window of surgical opportunity and the tumor may spread in this chemotherapy interim. But this is a false premise. The second criterion is a CA19-9 tumor marker that falls to a normal level after chemotherapy. CA19-9 is a tumor marker that is often used in pancreatic cancer. We have come to realize that the higher the tumor marker is at diagnosis, the worse the survival. If elevated, we want to see the CA19-9 drop with chemotherapy. Most medical centers typically want to see the CA19-9 just go down in general, but we found that those people whose CA19-9 went down to normal levels with chemotherapy treatment did significantly better in terms of survival than those whose CA19-9 dropped but was still elevated. Thirdly, we look for a tumor that, when surgically removed, was found to be all or mostly dead due to chemotherapy. If the preoperative treatment has led to complete or near complete death of the primary cancer, then it is very likely that the chemotherapy also killed any hidden or occult cancer cells elsewhere in the body, which we know most people have. Thus, these patients have the longest survival. If the primary cancer is still alive after this treatment, then the opposite is true. In the past, we typically didn't know this factor until after surgery when it's too late. We have incorporated positron emission tomography, or PET scans, heavily into our practice to judge effectiveness of chemotherapy. If the tumor is dead on a PET scan after chemotherapy, we have a much better predictor of that person's survival before considering surgery. This has been game-changing for people with pancreatic cancer. And here's the next question. How long does it typically take for a person undergoing chemotherapy to achieve the desired results? Is there a risk in continuing chemotherapy too long before having surgery? And here's his answer. This has continued to evolve. What started as only a couple of months has increased to a period of 6 months to a year to surgery, prior to surgery. Many thought that if a person didn't respond to initial chemotherapy, then he or she wouldn't respond to any chemotherapy. This was false. A significant portion of our patients undergo a switch in chemotherapy. This has also been practice changing. And the final question, what demographic groups benefit the most from this approach? Who, if anyone, doesn't qualify? And here's his answer. Up to half of all patients with pancreatic cancer, those in whom the cancer hasn't spread to other organs yet, are eligible for this approach. People who are older and sicker are more challenging to treat. However, we've successfully treated people age 80 and older. We are specifically using this approach in the third of patients whose tumors involve critical vascular structures and are considered inoperable elsewhere. We are now able to offer curative intent surgery for many of these patients here at Mayo Clinic that was otherwise not possible anywhere else. And moving on now to Consumer Reports on Health newsletter. The first article is The Safest Way to Get Your Health Screenings. Expert advice on handling colonoscopies and five other important tests right now. With the coronavirus still in our lives, you may wonder whether it's wise to get health screenings now or postpone them until you're vaccinated against COVID-19. Screenings, after all, are preventative to detect potential early warning signs of disease, not to treat a current health problem. While you want to stay up to date with screenings, they tend to be less urgent than a test or study that your doctor orders to evaluate a symptom, says Michael Hochman, MD, an internal medicine physician at Keck Medicine of USC in Los Angeles. You may also be unclear on which screenings you need. Some, like prostate cancer screenings, are not routinely advised for people over a certain age. Others, such as lung cancer screenings, are advised only if you have risk factors. Guidelines may also vary from medical association to medical association. It's best to talk with your doctor about the optimal screening schedule for you. To help, we've asked experts which screenings most older adults should stay on schedule with and which they can consider putting off or skipping. So the first one is the mammogram. And what is it? The breast X-ray helps detect lumps that may signal cancer. Who should have it? The American College of Physicians, which synthesized the advice from several medical organizations, advises a mammogram every other year for women between 50 and 74 at average risk. Ask your doctor about your risk level. While an annual mammogram slightly decreases breast cancer deaths in this age group, it also leads to many more false positive results, breast biopsies and overtreatment, says Dr. Jacqueline Fincher, president of the ACP. Can you postpone it? Pushing it off a month or two is fine, but more than 6 months could do more harm than good, Dr. Fincher says. Can you skip it altogether? In general, women 75 and older, or those with a life expectancy of 10 years or less, can stop having these screenings, the American College of Physicians says. The next test is the colonoscopy, and what it is, a doctor checks your rectum and colon for polyps or tissue masses. Polyps are usually harmless, but some can become cancerous. Polyps can be removed during colonoscopy. Who should have it? In general, those ages 45 through 75 at average risk, the American Cancer Society says. Ask your doctor about your risk level again. Can you postpone it? It's important to have it on time, Dr. Hochman says. If you'd prefer, ask your doctor whether you can do a home stool test instead. And can you skip it altogether? At age 76, talk with your doctor. The American College The American Cancer Society advises that people between 76 and 85 decide based on personal preferences, life expectancy, health, and screening history. American Cancer Society says people older than 75 at average risk or those with a life expectancy of less than 10 years can stop. The next test is a bone density scan. What it is, this is X-ray, also known as a DEXA scan, determines the strength of your bones. Who should have it? The U.S. Preventive Services Task Force recommends the screening for women 65 and older and postmenopausal women younger than 65 at higher risk for osteoporosis or brittle bones. Men 70 and older may want to talk to their doctors. For normal results, you can wait at least a decade for another screening. For low bone mass or osteopenia, you'll be rescreened every 3 to 5 years. For osteoporosis, every 2 years. Can you postpone it? It's best to have it. You don't want to find out about a higher risk fracture by slipping in your driveway and breaking your hip and ending up in the emergency room during the pandemic, says Dr. Sharon Brangman, chair of geriatrics at Upstate University Hospital in Syracuse, New York. Can you skip it altogether? Yes, if you're younger than 65 with no risk factors. The next one is Pap smear. What it is, this exam checks cervical cells for abnormalities that may lead to cancer. Who should have it? Generally, women younger than 65 and older women with a history of cervical cancer. The American Cancer Society and the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists advise a Pap test every 3 years or a Pap test along with a human papillomavirus test every 5 years. Can you postpone it? It's wisest to have it if you're due or overdue, Dr. Fincher says. Can you skip it altogether? Women without a cervix and those 65 and older who've had 3 normal Pap tests in a row in the prior 10 years can stop. The next test is a blood sugar test. What is it? A fasting glucose test measures your blood sugar or glucose levels after you've gone without calories for at least 8 hours. And an HbA1c test determines your average blood sugar levels over the prior 2 or 3 months. Who should have it? Adults between ages 40 and 70 who are overweight or obese. If results are normal, the task force says rescreening every 3 years may be a reasonable approach. Those with prediabetes or type 2 diabetes will have a different schedule. Can you postpone it? With prediabetes or type 2 diabetes, it's key to keep up. Poorly controlled diabetes can make you more vulnerable to COVID-19 complications. Otherwise, it can probably wait. Can you skip it altogether? If you're older than 75, talk with your doctor. There's no set age to discontinue screenings, Dr. Brangman says. It really depends on a person's overall health and life expectancy. And the last test is the cholesterol test. What is it? This blood test measures levels of LDL, or bad cholesterol, and HDL, or good cholesterol, and triglycerides, or fatty acids. Who should have it? Healthy adults should be screened every 4 to 6 years, the American Heart Association says. If you take a cholesterol-lowering statin drug, the AHA and the American College of Cardiology advise screening every 3 to 12 months. Can you postpone it? For a couple of months, but not much more, says Mary Tinetti, MD, a geriatrician at Yale School of Medicine in New Haven, Connecticut. Can you skip it altogether? If you're older than 75, ask your doctor, Dr. Tinetti says. There's less evidence that high cholesterol leads to heart disease in this age. And here's a sidebar. Do you need a yearly physical? Though some research suggests that a once-a-year exam offers few benefits for healthy adults younger than 65, it's a must for older adults, says Dr. Jacqueline Fincher, president of the American College of Physicians. She says that most seniors have at least one chronic condition that requires monitoring, and that doctors can assess for issues such as fall risk and depression during that appointment. It also allows older adults to maintain a rapport and a close connection with their doctor. If you're due for a physical but trying to minimize doctor's appointments, you can schedule it for after you get the COVID-19 vaccine. In the meantime, you can probably do much of your physical via telehealth, says Joshua Chodosh, MD. You would share information at on home screenings such as those for blood pressure with your doctor, too. But there are limits. It's hard to check someone's gait and balance over the internet, Dr. Chodos says. If you're not due but haven't seen a doctor since the pandemic hit, it's wise to have a virtual check-in, says USC's Michael Huckman, MD. Well, that's about all the time we have for now, and this has been Leslie with Independent Living. I hope you've enjoyed today's readings from the audio reading service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
This is a Recording Library of West Texas Community Update.
Watering schedule. The City of Midland has adjusted the lawn and landscaping watering schedule, which will allow residents to water 4 days a week instead of two. Even-numbered addresses can water on Sunday, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and odd-numbered addresses can water on Sunday, Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
As we live through one of the country's most severe economic downturns, we strive to bring you information about money, investing, consumer news, and the energy industry. Mondays at 6 a.m., it's the Kiplinger's newsletter and Money Matters. Tuesdays at 6 a.m., The Economist. Wednesdays at 6 a.m., a weekly roundup of the Lone Star State with News of Texas. Thursdays at 6 a.m., Consumer Reports. And Fridays at 6 a.m., Permian Basin Oil and Business News from the Midland Report. Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American. Weekday mornings at 6 on Recording Library of West Texas Radio.
To bring us up to time for our next regularly scheduled program, we now bring you the following informative feature.
To Your Good Health by Dr. Keith Roach. Soda on the Vice Spectrum. Dear Dr. Roach, I've never smoked, drank alcohol, or used illegal drugs. My doctor says I'm in great health. My only vice is drinking diet soda, and I drink 3 or 4 cans a day. I'd like to know what you think about it. I know it's not great for me, but I figure it's better than the other vices. PV. Answer. I'm not sure vice is the correct term. Compared with sugar-sweetened soft drinks, diet sodas are probably less harmful in several ways. Compared with plain water, they probably have some drawbacks. The effects vary by person, and the literature on this subject is mixed and controversial. For your teeth, less sugar means less cavities. However, diet sodas are acidic, and drinking too many can weaken the enamel on your teeth. The effect of diet sodas on weight is complicated. Paradoxically, many people will gain weight when switching to diet soda. Scientists believe this is due to effects on the bacteria in the intestines, the microbiome. Consuming sweet beverages may also stimulate the desire for other sweets and less healthy foods. Some of the sweeteners in diet sodas can cause intestinal problems in susceptible people, especially diarrhea and gas. If you have no symptoms from drinking diet sodas, have no weight issues, get your teeth checked regularly, and have good oral hygiene, then the risk from 3 or 4 daily cans of diet soda is modest. It's still better to drink plain water.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 61 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the low 50s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the mid-60s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the low 50s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas.
This program is made available to the IAAIS Program Share and was recorded at the Audio Reading Service of the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana, for people with print impairments.
Welcome. This is Able Living, and I'm your reader, Kevin, with the Audio Reading Service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Today I'll be reading from Disability Scoop, and now I'll begin with, IT Company Has One Goal, Hiring People on the Spectrum. The article written by Mark Williams of the Columbus Dispatch, and it is datelined Columbus, Ohio. An information technology consulting company is betting that the push to diversify the workplace extends to an applicant's brain. Oticon, a Berlin, Germany-based company that exclusively employs adults on the autism spectrum as IT consultants, has begun hiring workers in Columbus as part of its move to set up its regional headquarters here. There's a skill shortage in this area, said David Aspinall, Oticon CEO in the U.S. We can bring to bear talent that does have a performance advantage and at the same time help people. Oticon received approval for state tax incentives in 2019 to hire 50 people. The company's launch in Columbus has been slowed by the coronavirus. The company has 15 offices around the world, including in Europe, Canada, and the United States, employing more than 220 IT consultants on the autism spectrum. Its remote workers in Columbus partner with Ohio-based employers that need services in areas such as business analytics, artificial intelligence, and software development and migration. Many adults with autism struggle with employment despite having skill sets that can excel in the workplace, the company said. Various studies peg the unemployment and underemployment rate for those with autism at 80% or even 90%, said Carrie McGrow, who is on the board of directors of the National Autism Association and has autism. At the same time, about a third of those with autism have a college degree. It's quite shocking, he said of the high unemployment. McGrow, whose full-time job is public speaking, said many companies believe that hiring people along the autism spectrum is too costly. McGrow views his job as educating companies and their human resources departments about the value of hiring people with autism. Workers with autism are less likely to take their time off and more likely to stay at a company longer, he said. He also mentors young adults on the autism spectrum. Research shows so many families and so many in their community are more likely to buy products and back and support organizations in the disability community, McGrow said. Applicants with autism often don't disclose that they have autism during the interview process, he said. Many also find the interview process taxing. What often works better is for applicants to have a day-long tryout to show what they are capable of doing, McGrow said. Like other new workers, coaches and mentors can help them adapt. There aren't many companies or organizations that do what Oticon does, and those that do focus more broadly on people with disabilities in general. J.P. Morgan Chase & Company, Central Ohio's largest private employer, has a program called Autism at Work. In Columbus, Chase has hired about 30 workers along the autism spectrum through the program, most of whom hold technology positions with the bank. Oticon considers itself a for-profit operation that uses the principles of business to help overcome society's challenges, Aspinall said. We basically exist to effect positive change on that underemployment rate, he said. The company wants to hire workers at various levels of experience. Even software developers with 15 or 20 years of experience may feel underemployed if they work in an environment where their skills aren't being fully utilized, he said. Switching to a company such as Oticon helps them feel more connected to the people they work with, he said. An organization that has an appreciation for inclusion, he said. One of Oticon's Columbus clients, healthcare technology company CoverMyMeds, which placed one worker with a second to join shortly. Diversity, equity, and inclusion are embedded in our culture, said Veronica Knuth, the company's vice president of talent. Such a focus has been vital to CoverMyMeds' growth, she said. We have a track record of bringing in remarkable people with different backgrounds and abilities, Knuth said. We have employees on the spectrum in our business. With Oticon, it felt like such a natural match. It was so fun to be a part of that partnership. Next article, institutions serving those with IDD get new COVID-19 guidance by Michelle Diament. Nearly a year after institutions serving people with developmental disabilities locked down, federal officials are spelling out how and when these facilities should reopen their doors to visitors. In guidance issued in February, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services say that visitation should not be restricted without a reasonable clinical or safety cause. While CMS is focused on helping to protect clients and residents from the risk of contracting COVID-19, we also recognize that physical separation from family, caregivers, friends, and others has taken and continues to take a physical, emotional, and psychological toll on clients and residents, reads the 10-page document sent to states regarding visitations at intermediate care facilities for individuals with intellectual disabilities and psychiatric residential treatment facilities. In-person visits can still be restricted based on the local positivity rate, a facility or individual's COVID-19 status, and other factors, CMS said. But officials said the guidance details ways the facilities can welcome people again. Visitors should be screened for COVID-19 symptoms, required to wear masks, and expected to adhere to social distancing. They should be limited to certain areas of the facility, and there should be a cap on the number of simultaneous visitors allowed, according to the document. While outdoor visits are preferred, CMS indicated that institutions can accommodate people indoors if there are no confirmed or suspected virus cases at the facility. Even if institutions are restricting visitors, outsiders should still be allowed in for compassionate care situations, CMS said, and those circumstances are not limited to end of life. This could include situations where a new resident is struggling with their change in environment, a resident needs queuing and encouragement with daily care needs from a family member, or a resident is experiencing emotional distress as a result of limited social interactions, among other possibilities. Compassionate care visits can be conducted by family members, caregivers, or any individual that can meet the client and resident's needs, according to the guidance. In addition, CMS said the facility should make every effort to admit officials from state protection and advocacy systems, individuals to provide in-person supports necessary for equal access to care and effective communication under disability rights laws, as well as outside health care and service providers. Even if the facility is otherwise limiting in-person visitation, unless a visitor has COVID-19 symptoms or refuses to comply with the facility's infection controls practices, visitation should proceed, the guidance says of these groups. Within facilities, CMS indicated that residents may participate in group activities and eat in the same room together, so long as they are not suspected to have COVID-19 and that they maintain precautions such as keeping at least 6 feet apart and utilizing masks and appropriate hand hygiene. The guidance cites book clubs, crafts, movies, exercise, and bingo as examples of activities that can be conducted while following the protocols outlined. But institutions may limit communal activities depending on the status of infections at the facility, the document states. Our next article, written by Sean Heasley of Disability Scoop, it's entitled Biobank Poised to Transform Down Syndrome Research. The first of its kind effort is underway to collect biological samples from people with Down syndrome in a bid to improve care and outcomes for those with chromosomal disorder. Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center and the research advocacy group Down Syndrome Achieves said they are launching the DSA Biobank to provide a central repository for biological specimens for individuals with Down syndrome and their immediate families. The biobank is the first in the Down syndrome field to catalog, store, and openly share biosamples and associated health data for study, according to those behind the project, which has been years in the making. Blood, saliva, and tissue samples can be stored within the biobank that's being housed at a secure facility through the Discover Together Biobank at Cincinnati Children's. The specimens will be available for use in basic, translational, and clinical research. Individuals with Down syndrome from Lee Specialty Clinic in Louisville, Kentucky were enrolled during a pilot phase, and other Down syndrome specialty clinics are expected to be participating beginning later this year. The biobank has already started to approve research projects to receive samples. Lita Ramirez, CEO of Down Syndrome Achieve, said the biobank provides researchers with the potential to unlock some of the mysteries associated with Down syndrome. Currently, researchers do not have readily available blood and other samples to advance our understanding of the conditions that co-occur with Down syndrome, Ramirez said. I'm excited the Down syndrome community will have this national resource, which is long overdue. The next article, written by Michelle Diament, entitled CDC Urged to Prioritize COVID-19 Vaccines for People with Developmental Disabilities. With access to COVID-19 vaccines varying dramatically for people with developmental disabilities, advocates want the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention to update its prioritization plan to account for the high risk this population faces. In a letter to CDC leadership late last month, 16 advocacy groups called for people with developmental disabilities who are living independently in the community or with family to be added to Group 1B in the CDC's recommendations for the vaccine rollout. The agency has so far prioritized residents of long-term care facilities in Group 1A, the first to get vaccinated, which in many states includes people with developmental disabilities living in congregate settings. But the CDC has made no mention of those with similar diagnoses who live outside of group settings, such as a disparity is problematic. Advocates say, given the research has shown that people with developmental disabilities are far more likely to die from COVID-19 than others. Individuals with IDD are at a significantly higher risk compared to the general population, regardless of their living situation, reads a letter spearheaded by the American Academy of Developmental Medicine and Dentistry, a group for health professionals who provide clinical care to people with developmental disabilities. We believe that at-risk individuals with IDD must be prioritized explicitly along with the other high-risk diagnoses. Other groups that signed the letter include the American Association on Intellectual and Developmental Disabilities, the Autism Society of America, the National Association of Councils on Developmental Disabilities, the National Down Syndrome Congress, the National Down Syndrome Society, and the American Network of Community Options and Resources, or ANCOR. Decisions about COVID-19 vaccine access are being made at the state level, but many states are following the CDC's recommendations. As a result, a patchwork of approaches has emerged across the country, meaning that whether individuals with developmental disabilities have access to COVID-19 vaccines depends largely on what state or even which county they call home. At present, just 32 state plans account for this population in some manner, according to ANCOR, which represents disability service providers across the nation. But what that means in practice is inconsistent. Currently, there is significant variability in how individuals with IDD are prioritized in vaccine allocation frameworks. We ask that the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention provide a centralized framework for vaccine allocation with clear guidelines regarding risks that includes adults with IDD, the advocates wrote in their letter. The CDC did not respond to a request for comment on the matter. The next article is written by Lucille Sherman of the News and Observer. Parents wait or drive across state for autism therapy. This story is datelined out of Raleigh, North Carolina. North Carolina lawmakers are moving to eliminate a barrier to behavioral health care, in particular for children with autism. Healthcare providers known as behavior analysts provide therapy to a range of people, including those with autism. Some work one-on-one with the individuals with autism, including teaching kids with autism to talk, use the bathroom, or reduce self-harm. Under current state regulations, behavior analysts cannot practice independently. The work must be overseen by a licensed psychologist. Two pieces of legislation filed recently, if passed, would mean North Carolina will no longer be the only state with such a requirement. House Bill 91, sponsored by State Representative John Bell, a Republican from Goldsboro, and Senate Bill 103, sponsored by State Senator Jim Perry, a Republican from Kinston, would provide a path for behavior analysts to obtain licensure and practice on their own. It would also create a board tasked with licensing, disciplining, and setting rules for the providers. The legislators are joined by a number of their Senate and House colleagues who are also sponsoring the bill, including Representative Zach Hawkins, a Democrat from Durham, whose two children are on the autism spectrum. Hawkins said his children are able to receive care from behavior analysts, but many families in rural areas are not. In North Carolina, we say where the weak grow strong and the strong grow great, Hawkins said, and this bill is a bill that helps us exemplify that. The possible change, supporters say, would make it easier for thousands of families to get behavioral health care for their loved ones with autism. For us as a family, the most important thing is you want your child to reach their full potential, said Kyle Robinson, whose wife Bobby quit her job to drive their son from their home in Greenville to Winston-Salem every week for therapy. This bill is going to allow more access to care, which is really vital in eastern North Carolina, and also quality. Around one in every 39 children have autism spectrum disorder in North Carolina, according to the latest data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. That translates to more than 60,000 children with autism in the state, supporters of the bill said. But only an estimated 60 psychologists can also work independently, as board-certified behavior analysts, said Monique Baker, who is a behavior analyst and business owner serving 50 children with autism. This is why my company, along with 80% of applied behavior analysis companies in North Carolina, will continue to have long wait lists, some as long as 400 children, unless we pass this bill, Baker said. She called on lawmakers to reduce the unnecessary regulations that are keeping children with autism from getting the services that they desperately need. Behavioral analysts are licensed in more than 30 states, according to the Behavior Analysis Certification Board, and of the other states that do not license such practitioners, none require supervision. Former Republican Representative Chuck McGrady sponsored similar legislation in previous legislative sessions, garnering bipartisan support among lawmakers. The House passed the bill 112-2 in 2019, but it stalled in the Senate. The North Carolina Psychological Association also supports this legislation. Next article, entitled In-Group Homes, a Pandemic is Canceled, Plans Ushered in a New Normal. This article written by Isabella Rosario of the Ames Tribune. It is datelined out of Ames, Iowa. Missy Wearson didn't get to do anything for her 48th birthday in December because she was sick with COVID-19. I had to stay in my room, basically bored in my room, Wearson said. Her roommate Amber Kirk also contracted the virus and was unable to see her family over the holidays, stuck with a very bad cough and no appetite, she said. Spending Christmas in quarantine was one of the many setbacks Wearson and Kirk, who live in a group home through the Mainstream Living in Ames, have had to face during nearly a year of canceled plans, social distancing, and Zoom hangouts. This was really sad, but they handled it really well, said Judy Schieffer, the women's direct support professional at Mainstream Living, a program that serves people with intellectual disabilities and mental illnesses in Ames and Des Moines. Both women were excited when they received their first dose of the Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine. I'm so happy I got it, Wearson said. Around 700,000 Americans with intellectual or developmental disabilities live in a supervised residential setting, commonly called a group home, like those in nursing homes and long-term care facilities. People living in group homes are at high risk for COVID-19 due to underlying medical conditions, communal living, and close contact with caregivers. But the federal government is not counting outbreaks in group homes for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, whose studies say are 2 to 3 times more likely to die from COVID-19 than those without such disabilities. Preparing to protect a vulnerable population, Mainstream Living's pandemic emergency group implemented safety measures in last March, a year ago. Day habilitation programming at the center building was canceled. Visits were restricted all houses and offices. Families were encouraged to take their children home for a few weeks if they had the means to do so. We knew that having 5 members and then usually 2 to 4 staff, depending on the location and the time of the day, all in one living situations was going to make for a pretty high-risk environment, Mainstream Living Communications Director Amber Karori said. Approximately 40 residents have tested positive for COVID-19 in this past year, according to Karori. 7 residents had to be hospitalized. 1 resident, a woman living in Des Moines group home, died from the virus. This was incredibly difficult, especially for the staff and other members at that particular site, Courier said. As the pandemic has stretched on, greater knowledge of how COVID-19 spreads has helped stem outbreaks, Courier said, so that 1 positive test does not necessarily result in illness for the entire household. Masks are worn by all who are able to. Staff wear mask shields when they help residents brush their teeth or use the restrooms. The leadership team has since lifted some restrictions. Residents are able to visit family and vice versa, although gathering sizes are limited. When it was warmer outside, residents took socially distanced trips to local parks, rose gardens, and apple orchards. Karori said that while taking precautions, the leadership team is focused on making sure that the rights of our members and those that we serve remain a priority. We believe strongly in the value of making sure that people with disabilities are integrated fully into their community, working, living, playing, just like the rest of us, she said. Some group home residents have been spending a lot more time inside than they are used to and miss hanging out with their friends at other houses and competing in the Special Olympics. In some cases, they miss their jobs. Wearson said Kirk used to work at Dan Foss through Mainstream Living's Employment Assistance Program, which has been paused to lessen residents' virus exposure. I felt really sad because I didn't get to see my friends, Wearson said, of having to stop working. Before the pandemic, direct support professional Rachel Stone worked in the day habilitation program and was always very active, she said. Stone understands when residents feel bored or understimulated because she sometimes feels the same way. When I was having those feelings, it was hard for me to almost step aside and put on the DSP shoes, Stone said. It's like a whole new part of our role. Emotional support has always been a piece of what we do, but it seems like it's so much more now. Over time, staff and residents have slowly adjusted to this new normal, Stone said. There have been lots of puzzles, crafts, baking, and board games. A weekly quarantine and chill over Zoom helps residents connect. We keep and say hi to our other friends and stuff at different sites, Kirk said. With the day habilitation program canceled, the staff is more isolated in the houses they support, Stone said, but they often reach out to one another on Facebook, holding each other up and praising each other for good ideas, because everybody needs a little more positivity right now.
Even with the added stress of COVID-19, Schieffer, who works with Weirson and Kirk, can't imagine doing anything else. I feel like I'm doing my heart's work, Schieffer said. A few weeks ago, the three built a snowman together, but instead of a carrot for a nose, they decorated his face with a surgical mask. Our next article, written by Sean Heasley, entitled With Disabilities Rarely Seen, Netflix Commits $100 Million Toward Inclusion. Netflix is pledging to do more after a report finds the representation of people with disabilities and other groups is lacking in its original films and television shows. The report, released late last week, was conducted by Stacy Smith at the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism, who regularly analyzes diversity on screen, and was asked by Netflix to assess its work. Smith and her team reviewed 126 films and 180 series released in 2018 and 2019 to measure representation by gender, race and ethnicity, LGBTQ+, and disability. While the study gave Netflix good marks on gender equality and for making progress in inclusion of those from some underrepresented racial and ethnic groups, it found that the LGBTQ+ community and people with disabilities rarely see themselves in content on the streaming service. Characters with disabilities accounted for just 5.3% of leads and 4.7% of the main cast in film and series on Netflix, the study found. When all speaking characters were factored, only 2.1% had disabilities. This is far short of reflecting 27.2% of the population who really have disabilities, report noted. When individuals with disabilities were shown, they were likely to be male and were mostly white. Slightly more than half of these characters had physical disabilities. Researchers observed little change in representation of people with disabilities between 2018 and 2019, concluding that there is room for Netflix to grow in order to depict the full range of how people experience disability. Notably, the report found that strong representation behind the camera among certain groups like women led to better representation of those groups on the screen. In response, Netflix said it will establish a fund that will invest $100 million over the next 5 years in organizations that help bring underrepresented communities into the television and film industries and in programs to train and hire new talent at that company. This study sets a high bar for the wider industry and demonstrates how an internal audit is a critical first step toward inclusive change, Smith said. Ted Sarandos, co-CEO and chief content officer of Netflix, said the company is committed to releasing a new version of the inclusion report every 2 years through 2026. By better understanding how we are doing, we hope to stimulate change not just in Netflix, but across our industry more broadly, Sarandos said. Well, that's all the time we have for today. This has been Kevin with Able Living. Hope you've enjoyed today's reading from the audio reading service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, the Center's Solutions Podcast, followed by the Noon Book Hour at 12. This week on the Recording Library of West Texas Radio's Saturday Night Movie, we continue our series of Academy Award-winning films. This year, the Academy Award ceremony is April 25th through April 24th. Each Saturday, we will air movies from each decade that won the Oscar for Best Picture. This week, we're to the 60s as we air the audio-described 1962 classic, Lawrence of Arabia, starring Peter O'Toole, Alec Guinness, Anthony Quinn, Omar Sharif, and a cast of other stars, directed by David Lean. Lawrence of Arabia was a British production, which was nominated for 10 Oscars and won 7, including Best Picture. The film is widely regarded as one of the greatest and most influential films ever made. In 1991, it was selected by the United States Library of Congress for preservation in the National Film Registry. Before that year's Oscars, it wasn't edited after its premiere and ran over 220 minutes. Slightly more than 1 minute more than Gone with the Wind, therefore making it the longest movie to ever win a Best Picture Oscar, and at the time, produced with an astronomical budget of $15 million, shot on location in Jordan, Morocco, and Spain.
I deem him one of the greatest beings alive in our time. We shall never see his like again. His name will live in history. It will live in the annals of war. It will live in the legends of Arabia.
Who is he? stop it. Tapas!
What is your name?
My name is for my friends.
None of my friends is a murderer.
Come on, man!
For over a quarter of a century, controversy has raged around the name of T.E. Lawrence. No man of our time has drawn upon himself so much praise and so much criticism. Lawrence of Arabia, the man torn between two civilizations. Lawrence of Arabia, filmed against a canvas of awesome magnificence.
But I would like to hear his opinion.
Damn it, Lawrence, who do you take your orders from?
From Lord Faisal, in Faisal's tent.
Hailing the birth of a new star, Peter O'Toole as Lawrence of Arabia. What was he really like, this controversial figure who became a legend in his own lifetime?
He was the most extraordinary man I ever knew.
He was a very great man.
He was a poet, a scholar, and a mighty warrior. He was also the most shameless exhibitionist since Barnum and Bailey.
What, in your opinion, do these people hope to gain from this war?
They hope to gain their freedom.
There's one born every minute.
They're going to get it, Mr. Bentley. I'm going to give it to them.
Lawrence and Arabia. Together, they made history. Now, a gathering of international stars unfolds the story. Alec Guinness as Prince Faisal.
The English have a great hunger for desolate places. Fear they hunger for Arabia.
Anthony Quinn as Auda Abu Tayyi.
I carry 23 great wounds, all got in battle. 75 men have I killed with my own hands in battle. I scatter, I burn my enemies' tents. I take away their flocks and herds. The Turks pay me a golden treasure, yet I am poor. Because I am a river to my people.
Jack Hawkins as General Allenby.
I believe your name will be a household word when you would have to go to the War Museum to find who Allenby was.
You're the most extraordinary man I ever met.
Leave me alone.
What?
Leave me alone.
Jose Ferrer as the Turkish Bey.
Your skin is very fair.
Also starring Anthony Quayle, Claude Rains, Arthur Kennedy, with Omar Sharif as Ali and Peter O'Toole as Lawrence.
The 1963 winner for Best Picture, Lawrence of Arabia. Audio described Saturday night at 7 on Recording Library of West Texas Radio.
To bring us up to time for our next regularly scheduled program, we now bring you the following informative feature.
Bowel changes could be IBS symptoms. Dear Dr. Roach, my 18-year-old daughter has had digestive problems on and off for a few years now. Her appendix was removed in March 2015. She had brutal abdominal pain, but the ultrasound scan didn't show anything wrong with her appendix. Summer 2018, she started having bad digestion problems. She could hardly hold anything in. The food came back out either by diarrhea or vomiting. Our family doctor sent her to a pediatric gastroenterologist. She had a complete workup, including stool cultures, the entire thing. They found nothing wrong with her. Now she has noticed that eating anything warm makes her feel wobbly. She often eats a popsicle when that happens, and the wobbliness magically disappears. Do you think it could be a problem with her vagus nerve? Our family doctor is not taking this possibility seriously at all and will not investigate it. She now has diarrhea only once or twice a month, which starts with pain or discomfort. She occasionally still has vomiting. The abdominal discomfort gets somewhat better after a bowel movement, but it's really the popsicle that makes it get better. J.M. Answer. Abdominal pain and changes in the bowel, especially in a young woman, should make the doctor consider irritable bowel syndrome. IBS is a disorder with how the bowel functions. It is extremely common, but many patients do not seek medical attention. People with irritable bowel syndrome may have diarrhea, constipation, or both, in addition to the abdominal pain. Relief of abdominal discomfort with a bowel movement supports the diagnosis of IBS. People with IBS generally find that certain foods trigger symptoms. However, I was able to find reports of people in whom meal temperature was a major catalyst. Both too cold meals and too hot meals can bring on IBS. If a too hot meal was a problem, it makes sense something cold may help, although some people can be triggered by both. I can only scratch the surface of this complex disease. There are many good places to find out more, including https://gi.org/topics/irritable-bowel-syndrome/. To your good health, Dr. Keith Roach. Roach's column appears Tuesdays through Saturdays. Readers may write him at P.O. Box 536-475, Orlando, Florida,